We'd like to welcome back to Stage Door Podcast, Vaya Pashos, who is a guest we have had once on the show before. We actually had her on twice, but I never edited that episode, and it's just lying abandoned on my hard drive somewhere. So maybe we'll release that as a deep cut sometime.
Let's just say I didn't have the best time at The King and I.
Oh, yeah, that was The King and I review, wasn't it? So welcome back to Stage Door Podcast to Vaya Pashos.
Thanks for having me.
Vaya now has her own podcast, Neighbours, which you can check out, which actually won a giant award last year in the Australian Podcast Awards. What are they called? The potties? The casties?
We'll call them the potties. The Castaway Awards.
Oh, the Castaway Awards, yeah.
Earlier this year, the inaugural. And it's actually been a lot of crossover because I try and get out to as much Melbourne theatre as I can, particularly if there's a Neighbours actor.
Yep.
In a show.
Yeah.
So every now and then I do a little mini review and let me know if you guys know of any Neighbours alumni treading the boards.
Now, Vaya and I have been to see a number of shows together in the last few years and we have tended to have quite bad luck. I don't know what it was exactly, but we just kept going to see duds and that was quite stressful.
And sometimes there'll be great performances in a dud show.
Yeah. Don't worry, the listeners of Stage Door Pod are very familiar with the art of mining shit for diamonds and finding, you know, the little nuggets of gold that still work within something that overall just it's not happening. But that didn't stop the fact that there were several shows that we saw where, well, at least one where I contemplated if it was possible to climb over the edge of the balcony that we were sitting on and escape out the side, because that was the only possible way to leave without disrupting the whole show. But it was so bad, I was like, I can't stay here. I can't do this. I just can't.
So I was a little nervous at the start of this show in particular.
Because
I just looked over at you a couple of times. It took me a few minutes to relax into it because I thought, oh, my God, is she going to want to bottle it?
Yeah, no, I was loving it, but I was also freezing. We need to just discuss at some point how freaking cold I was in that theatre because that was causing an issue. But anyway, no, I was enjoying it right from the get-go, but I was also freezing cold. So it was hard for you to tell what exactly I was experiencing. And I was aware that you were... Yeah.
Also, we'd flown interstate to see this, so there was a lot riding on this
one. There really was. So we went to see Only Heaven Knows, a production of an Australian musical from 1988 that was being done at the Hayes Theatre in Sydney by Luckiest Productions. The show is originally written book, music and lyrics by Alex Harding, and this production was directed by Sean Rennie and musically directed by Michael Tyack, musically supervised by Daniel Edmonds. I've always wanted to see Only Heaven Knows because I know it's a pretty like essential piece of Australian theatre history, but it's very rarely produced. As far as I know, it's not been done in Melbourne, like or at least not with any prominence in the last, you know, decade or something. I knew that there was a production with David Campbell in the 90s at the Sydney Opera House and there's a recording of that. So that's like got a reasonable profile. But I guess it's one of those like if you're an Australian theatre nerd, it's just one of those little kind of nuggets of, oh, wow, I wish I could have seen that shows.
And it is so perfectly Sydney. It was just the perfect spot to see it.
Yeah, seeing it at the Hayes Theatre right near the Cross, which is the area like if you walk out of the theatre, a lot of the locations that are mentioned in the show are exactly just right there. Written in 1988 but set in the 1940s and 50s and basically about what life was like for gay men in Sydney during that era. And they were different sort of characters embodying different sort of archetypes. So it's basically the overall effect is that you're looking at a sort of found family situation. We've got five different characters who've all come to mean different things to each other in different ways, but none of them related to each other, but they're like a family because as gay people or sort of societal outcasts, they're like coming together and living together, including their female friend, the amazing, what do they call her? Guinea. Yeah, she was hilarious.
Guinea, yeah, and I guess she was divorced and
exactly.
Making it on her own.
People gave her, you know, looks like she was a prostitute because she lived alone and whatever. Anyways, hard times to be an alternative theatrical type in Sydney in the 1940s and 50s.
And we saw this show a week ago and we were all set to talk about it immediately the next day, but I think we kind of needed a hot minute to
Stop crying first.
I've never seen Jelly cry in theatre before. Yeah. At theatre. It was amazing. Usually I'm the one. And I got to say, we had to buy two programs. Typically, we go to the theater and Jelly, much, it's like she's taking me on school excursion, goes and we went to Annie and she's like, now let me go get your program, and shouts me a program like I'm getting a fairy floss at the fair. And this time she buys the program and clutches it to her bosom and I couldn't get a look in it, and she was just crinkling it and holding it to herself. And at intermission, I'm like, I got to go get another program.
You said to me, yes, I had to get my own one because you kept folding it. Because I didn't even realize I was like shoving in my bag, taking it out, opening it, shoving it again, pouring at it. It was. I had to keep looking at it because I just found this was a terribly moving show. The show as it stands is not flawless. In some ways, it's a bit sort of sprawling and undirected in its focus, and some of the dialogue's a little bit awkward. Certainly the beginning starts off in a sort of strange way.
The first few minutes, that's when I was looking at you and I was worried.
Worried too.
And there was kind of a flurry of like almost a little montage of the main character, Tim, played by Ben Hall, who I know from Neighbours, making his way to Sydney. And it's a bit like there's a bit of choreography, which we liked in the show, but in that opening sort of there was a flurry of movement and bodies and voices, and I thought, uh-oh, what is happening?
Yeah.
And then when it kind of got to Sydney and calmed down and I had a minute to sort of ease into it, I was like, okay, it's going to be all right. It's going to be okay.
Yeah, I just don't think the dialogue at the beginning introduces the characters particularly effectively. It takes you a while to settle into who everyone is, and it also took the cast a while to settle into the show that night. I don't know if it was anxiety or tiredness, because it was the final show in a long week of shows.
It was
a two-show day. But I don't know, it was about halfway through that first act that I went, okay, I get this now, I get where we're going. I think, to be honest, I think there's mostly a flaw just of the structure or the difference in the way that theatre is now to how it was then.
And I think I wanted to know a bit as well, because Tim sort of just off he goes from the country. We establish he's living with his aunt and uncle who have brought him up, and we don't quite know, and he's 17, we don't quite know why.
You later find out that he's struggling because he feels like his cousin died in the war. His aunt and uncle have taken him on, and he feels like he was a failed replacement for the kind of like strong embodiment of the Australian male that this guy represented who died in the war. And here he is, like the thoughtful, weak, like pansy guy.
Yeah, I just didn't understand what was driving him to Sydney.
I just knew, because I guess I just know this trope so well. I was like, well, let's come to Sydney because he lives on a farm and his farmer uncle wants to beat him up because he's a faggot. That's, you know, this is like just the standard tale, really.
But also a few minutes in, I didn't matter.
It really becomes about how attached you become to the characters and the relationships they have with each other. It's sort of like a Disney movie where all the misfits come together and support each other and love each other, and you're just like, I'm just so glad someone's being nice to Tim. Oh, look, and someone's being nice to Cliff too. Oh, no, they're falling in love. Oh.
The other thing that I think rattled us right off the bat was that in the foyer before the show, a friend of ours who was seeing the show with us was, I guess, putting a bit of fear into us because she was looking at, we said, well, what's it about? She said, well, it was produced in the late 80s, in the middle of like the AIDS crisis going on, and there were signs all up in the theatre about shock treatment being depicted in the show, and we just started getting really worried and panicked about how terrifying this was going to be and how much we were going to be put through the ringer. And then it took a while to actually settle down and go, oh, there are some fun, good times in here. And it's
definitely true that I wasn't sure if it was going to be like a full 360-degree pain experience. I guess when a show is written in the 1980s, at the heart of the AIDS crisis, and it's talking about the gay experience, you don't expect a happy ending. But it's interesting to sort of look at the timeline of stuff written at that time and see this is written at the point at which people had started to try to write a story that was other than "and we're all going to die."
Yeah.
It was like, okay, there's got to be another ending to this story. So while this is an emotional and at times traumatic journey, I think the thing I really took away from it was that it came with this message of hope, that there's always a future and there's always a way to go on, and it's about connection to community. So as long as you're connected to your community, they're connected to you, and you're connected to the people who come before you and the people who are going to come, you'll be all right. And that's what I took from the show.
And for me, it was really powerful because I just really appreciated seeing a gay love story not as the secondary characters, not as, yeah, a comedic B storyline, just front and center, gay relationship. It was a young guy finding his footing in a romance setting, and then you get to not only get to see them get together, but you get to see that relationship evolve over decades. Amazing. You get to see them live together.
I kept being surprised when they were all gay. Like, it's so, you're so used to it being a supporting character, yeah, or a secondary character. You go, oh no, we're that one too. Oh, but also him. Oh, but it's everyone's gay journey.
Yeah, and it just put a lot of my own relationships into perspective, because you just, it's a bit of, it makes you check your privilege, because you're looking at this going, this is the same for a lot of people today. They mm-hmm. can't be overt about who their partner is.
Yeah, it was quite confronting to hear that story about, you know, one of the storylines is that characters have been caught, the two men have been caught hooking up while they're in the army together, so been sent to prison for like 10 years or something, right? Yeah. Or that for a substantial amount of time they've been sent to prison as in punishment. And I'm like, oh yeah, because it was illegal. Like, whoa.
And again, it's set in the 40s, produced in the 80s. It's now being put on in 2017, and there's so much that hasn't changed or is changing at a glacial
pace. Just the idea about whether or not where you can hold hands. I mean, it's not unusual for gay people to have to think about that quite often.
So it was just inherently heartbreaking for me, but so uplifting that the story is being told. And I just, wanted to race out and bring a whole bunch of people to see it.
I agree. In terms of the strengths of the book, I think the real strength lay in the monologues. There are a couple of extremely strong character-driven monologues where characters sort of revealing, you know, well, like you do in a monologue, your internal thoughts and feelings. A particularly moving one where the character of Lana, who played the very confident theatrical character, and this was an incredible performance by Hayden T, who was recently seen not just here but all around the world, actually, in the role of Javert in Les Mis.
Oh.
He was a really good Javert.
Wow.
He was probably – he really – brought sort of a youth and vitality to the role. Also, he made Javert just like extra gay, not through campness, but I feel like he really played that subtext as text, you know, the whole Valjean thing, which is really interesting. But it's such a kind of aggressively masculine, like, here I am with my don't fuck with me, Valjean kind of vibe. And here he is playing an extremely camp, flamboyant character that could have just been a real kind of stereotype, but he also found these moments to play him as a character with incredible stillness and compassion. And he had this beautiful monologue where he's in the toilet block where he and his dead lover are used to spend time together, and he's scattering his ashes there.
That was beautiful.
It was. And at the one time, on the one hand, you're going, this is such a beautiful monologue. And then you're going, it was so hard for these guys to really be together that a toilet block was their significant place. And on the other hand, there was quite a lot of defensiveness within the show that, like, well, there's nothing wrong with the toilet block. Yeah. There's nothing wrong with the park. You shouldn't see it as us hiding or as a sad thing. Sometimes that's a place where you can actually have a beautiful connection. Wow, I'd never thought of that before.
Yeah. And so, that monologue was punctuated with heaps of jokes too.
So many gags. Good. It was brilliant. Just overall the monologues, I was like, you know, put these on your NIDA showcase list.
It kept, in those moments, I kept forgetting it was a musical.
Yeah.
Interesting
that you mentioned that.
A little while later, I'm like,
I think they forgot to.
They're singing now. But you forget in those moments of dialogue, you're like, wow, this is so powerful.
Yeah. The monologues and parts of the dialogue were incredibly powerful. The music, the score is pleasant. At least when you're listening to it, it is a pleasant experience. Not hugely memorable, I would say, overall. I think my favourite song was, and they're actually not listed in the program, but the one where...
Yeah, I was struggling. I was trying to find a list and I...
The one where Alan was dressing Tim. So they're getting dressed for a ball.
Yes, that was so great.
Yeah, and they're sort of squabbling over what they're going to wear, and it's a bit of a, you know, it's a duet and it's kind of a... they're singing a little... You know, each one of them's revealing what they think about the other. And you find out heaps about them and that they like each other, but they're kind of rivals as well for Cliff's affection. And, yeah, it was really funny. But the music, it's interesting, the Hayes Theatre, right? So according to our friend Sarah Fletcher, a sometime podcast correspondent and longtime podcast fan, she was saying the Hayes Theatre has had an issue with sound. So when they're doing musicals, they usually mic the singers and the band, and you can't hear the singers, and it's a real issue. It's a tiny little theatre.
Yeah.
And so what they did with this show was just use a piano, only a piano, and they didn't mic anyone. How did you think that worked?
Well, loved the piano. I was a little put off by the non-microphone situation because it panicked me a little bit. I thought, uh-oh, we're going to have to work a bit harder to hear everybody.
And you do, actually.
And some people, it was work to their strengths to project in that way, and other people, it wasn't as natural for them. So
I guess you could tell who was really used to singing with amplification and perhaps relied on it a little bit, and who was just a very confident singer with a lot of training and experience. It, within the cast, it did kind of expose that. That said, they were all very nice singers.
Yeah, they were all beautifully presented pieces, and particularly the one, is it just after the intermission in the start of the second act, that little song and dance number they do?
Yeah, that was fantastic. Gosh, that was funny. Killing myself laughing.
It was kind of out of world.
Yeah, really. Yeah. There were out of world songs that they sang. So they also had the Hayden T. Dubling as a drag queen character who is a sort of a present day character, and he made contemporary comments. So I assume that's meant to be present day. Making these present day comments, commenting on the action, and he's meant to be a ghost haunting the area, right?
Oh, I didn't pick that.
Yeah, it was a little – the drag queen stuff didn't really work for me. It's fine. I feel like it highlighted how difficult it is to do drag really well, especially when you're jumping in and out of that character. Paul Hayden T had to put his false eyelashes on and off about 15 times.
There were a couple of drag characters and I thought they looked amazing. I just thought, visually, I read them as different characters when they were as one and as the other. Jelly did struggle at one point with the drag performance, but I nudged her and said, lean into it. Because I think for me, I felt like I was watching kind of an amateur drag night at a local bar or something. It kept me in that moment for me. It wasn't like I was in Vegas watching like a high glitz stage show.
Yeah,
it was like sort of a subdued, low-key kind of performance, and so that's why it worked in that way for me. But I did kind of prefer the action with the main players.
Yeah, and there was, I thought, among the songs that worked, there were the diegetic songs, and they're the ones where it's like Guinea's a performer in this world of the play and here she is performing at her nightclub or whatever, and then that stuff perhaps didn't work as well, which was not a comment on the performance at all, but just they were sort of written to sound like standards of the 40s and 50s, but they're not standards of the 40s and 50s, because if it was a standard, it'd be a killer song and you'd know it. You know, if she was singing My Funny Valentine, she'd be singing My Funny Valentine, but it was sort of like a My Funny Valentine-ish type song.
Yeah, they were sort of almost trying to remind us that it was a period piece, but I felt like it didn't need that, because kind of like watching Miss Fisher's Murder Mysteries or something, yes, it's set in the 20s, but she's equipped with a lot of modern tropes.
Yeah.
So it's just kind of a set piece. You don't have to worry too much about, they're not talking on their mobile phones. Like you don't have to worry. We don't have to be reminded that it's another decade, because the story is kind of supposed to feel current, because a lot of these issues still are. So I feel like it didn't need that technique of constantly reminding us of the time.
Well, that was interesting that you and I were slightly in disagreement about that, because I felt a little bit confused. I thought in a way the setting of it in the 40s and 50s created a few really significant things. It threw a few really big blockers in front of their relationships being able to continue and things like that. But the dialogue felt strangely modern at times. Mm. For the most of the time, they weren't speaking in a dialect. Their accent sounded modern for the most part. I'd say with the exception of Blazey Best as Guinea and Tim Draxel as Cliff, the way they spoke, the accent they spoke in felt like an Australian accent of the 40s and 50s. Right. Whereas most of the others spoke in what I would term as like a modern sounding vernacular or whatever. Yeah. I don't know if that's the writing or their like vocal coaching. I couldn't really tell you, but I did feel like that Blazey and Tim felt different to the others.
Right.
And you were like, I just sort of went with it as an overall sort of vibe. It was here, it was now, it was also then and there, and it just worked for you. Whereas I was like, I'm confused. Why are they talking like that if it's the 50s? Oh, I suppose it doesn't matter because they're just in the 50s because now love, tortured, romance, etc.
And also with your international listeners that you might not be aware that with when we consume Australian performance, like theatre or TV or film, we're used to this kind of hodgepodge of this patchwork quilt of voices, because sometimes you'll get they're doing the American dialect for the international shows, or they'll be doing, as I said before, like Miss Fisher, if they're doing period drama, sometimes it's a bit of a mixed bag of a voice that sounds modern or someone who's more classically trained and can do those sorts of period voices. But
do you like hearing an Australian accent on stage like we did in this show?
I did for this. Yeah, I did for this, as particularly because we see so many musicals from overseas and we never get Aussie voices. Yeah. Strictly Ballroom was the last musical I think I saw with an Aussie with Aussie voices.
Oh my God, I'm really sorry that you saw that.
I loved it.
Oh, don't get me started. I want my money back. Give me my money back, Baz.
I want to see it again.
No.
I loved it.
Oh my God, that was a very tiresome night at the theatre. That was one of the only nights ever that I've gotten to interval and said, I'm now going to start drinking because I'm not making it through Act 2. Anyway.
Also, that was a jukebox musical. So
yeah, I know, but it's a way to take the crown jewel of Australian cinema and turn it into one of the most tacky and embarrassing nights I've ever endured. Anyway, speaking of, let's talk about performances.
Yes.
Because really, the show is beautiful and it's a beautiful love story to the gay community. And it has some really nice songs and it's got some very powerful monologues. But the whole show really worked because of the skillfulness of the performance and I'm assuming the skill of the direction in getting those performances out there. I really, really loved Tim Draxel as Cliff. And in the end, Cliff becomes the constant thread through the show. Well, Act 1 is mostly about Tim. That protagonist actually disappears for a good part of Act 2.
Yeah.
And we're left with Cliff, who's the older, more experienced gay guy who's been in prison for homosexuality, who's now carrying the dilemma of the second half of the show, which is how do we turn this relationship into something long term? We can't can we live together? How do we get a house? What do we do?
There's something to be said for his charms when you're not at all put off by the fact that he's aggressively pursuing this 17-year-old kid who hasn't come to terms with his own sexuality.
No, it just seems like the most natural, beautiful thing in the world.
Yeah.
But what do you mean? Like, what was it about his performance that made that not creepy?
Because it was so purely founded in just love and infatuation and care for this person, this other person, and wanting to just be in their orbit. And
also, I guess, you felt that Tim was really vulnerable. He didn't know how to be gay in a safe way, like when there's all this potential pitfalls and traps for him to fall into. You just wanted people to look after him as much as anything. Yes. And Cliff was in love with him, but he also really had his best interests at heart. So I was like, you go.
Yeah, it was.
And Tim Draxel's, it was a very masculine, sort of very strong performance, but also with incredible tenderness when he was with Dan.
Then the love scenes were so wonderful.
Yeah.
Just the fact that they had that.
I called him Dan instead of Ben. Oh. Incredible love and also just incredible tenderness when he's with Tim. That's fine. What you said will still be there.
Yeah.
The love scenes were incredibly.
And
can we say just, hot as well?
Yeah.
They're really hot.
Hot.
Can we see more naked gay men in bed kissing, please?
And just the earnestness of the performance.
Oh, like, my gosh. It was just beautiful.
You could tell they cared a lot about the material and wanting to do it justice.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And the demographic that was watching it was clearly a big part of this story's history.
Every older gay man in Sydney, everyone there looks like my dad.
So there's a lot of responsibility on these performers to nail that.
It's a really interesting point. I would love to talk to them about how they felt about dealing with that responsibility.
We should have asked them because we kind of accosted them all afterwards and just gushed how great.
They just politely backed away from us.
We could have asked them some more intellectual questions. We'll tweet them.
Tim Draxel's a really well-known Australian performer. I've seen him in stuff since he was I think he was in The Sound of Music when he wasn't much more than a teenager. He was Rolf the Nazi postman. And I'm always so sad for Rolf as a character. But anytime I see a Rolf actor doing something else, I'm like, you go, Rolf. You got out of the, get away from those Nazis.
Is this because there's not much room to move as Rolf?
It's just that tragedy of that moment towards the end when you can see he thinks about letting them go and he thinks about going with them and Captain von Trapp says, come with us.
Yeah.
You don't have to do this.
And there's a way out and he doesn't take
it. Yeah, and he's thinking about it and then von Trapp pushes it too far. He says, you'll never be one of them. And I'm like, no, that's why they joined. They wanted, he wants the uniform. He wants the thing. He wants to be part of it. Don't say you'll never be a part of them. You just played right into his Achilles heel. Then he blows his little Nazi whistle and it's all over.
Anyway, well, more to be said on that when we do our spin-off Sound of Music podcast.
We're going to do the film in 5-minute increments. We could. We could do a half hour on every 5 minutes.
100% we are doing this.
Oh, my God.
I'm going to grab a notepad and brainstorm.
Yep. So Tim Draxel, what I felt like he brought to the show as well was just so much experience. He filled that space.
It was his love story with the Tim character, Ben Hall. And I think he played a 17-year-old doll-eyed kid unbelievably well.
I would have believed that he was a teenager, particularly in that first half. He somehow managed to make himself look so small, like his body language, the way he stood, his shoulders and everything. He looked so young and they wardrobed him perfectly.
Yeah, in the deli apron. The first time they said he was 17, I thought, well, this is going to be a suspension of disbelief. You know, here we go. But I he was a teenager to me.
And Ben Hall's done a number of musicals. He's also done quite a lot of telly. He's a bit of an up-and-comer, extremely talented. One of the most symmetrical faces I've ever seen. Pretty extraordinary-looking guy.
Quote-unquote, Jelly said he was bankable like a Hemsworth.
Yeah, he is. This guy is really something, you guys. I've got to say, I think he's going to be a huge star. It feels like Margot Robbie, like seeing Margot Robbie in early time on Neighbours and going, oh, that's, she's something different.
100%. And we interviewed him on Neighbours.
Oh, it's a fantastic episode. I recommend you listen.
Neighbours recap with us. It was brilliant. And
smart guy for someone so good looking.
Very intelligent, good sport, good looking. So clearly he will leave the country soon because they don't stick around.
Nope, they don't. I was thrilled to see he's appeared in falsettos. I would have killed to see that. He would have been really great. What's I'm assuming he played Whizzer. It's a Broadway musical from the early 90s about the gay experience and written by William Finn, who did Putnam County Spelling Bee, if you've seen that show.
We're out of my depth.
Okay.
I'm out of my depth.
You'd love it, by the way.
We need to talk about Matthew Backer. Was he Alan?
Yes, we do. Yes.
I'm going to skip right to the bit that destroyed me.
Was the bit that I missed because I had my eyes closed?
Yeah, Jelly couldn't cope. It was in the second act. It was the bit that we were warned about in the foyer about the shock treatment. He was getting shock treatment.
Oh, yeah.
There was a bit of a time jump.
Yeah, and his character decides to talk about Ellen in the first half first.
Okay. He's the one that was hiding behind a lot of costumes and wardrobe in the first half.
I didn't notice that. What a brilliant observation.
Oh, thanks. He was using this masquerade party, this costume party that they were attending as his chance to dress up and show his real self behind the veneer of costumes. And
they also happened to have that actor double a number of parts where he played like a woman or other people in their community, and he did.
He was such a good chameleon.
I hadn't even thought of that until you mentioned it. But you're right. Several times I had to go, is that same guy?
Yeah.
Because I couldn't believe it was him.
And it's funny because he seems like the most confident in his sexuality almost.
In the show, initially. Yeah. He's the other half of the couple who's been caught out in the army for being gay.
Yeah, because he's quote unquote flamboyant. He's wearing silk robes and swanning about the stage and, telling young Tim what's what. And you think, okay, he's all about it.
I felt sort of safe with him. Like, all right, Alan knows what's what. Yeah. He knows how to do the gay. Let's continue.
And then bang, second act, he's in this psychologist's room and getting the shock treatments. And it was, oh my God, the physical pain he was.
Well, it wasn't just, his character decides to undergo what looks like a chemical and like electric process of shocking himself back to being straight that involved all this kind of self-hatred and trying to, it was his family who'd given him his house or given him money or something, and he was trying to be straight again for them. And he also, I think we can read into it, he's a little heartbroken that Cliff is now with Tim and he doesn't have anyone.
Yeah, Jelly was shipping Cliff and Alan
by the end. Well, spoilers.
Even though I was like, end game, Tim and Cliff, whatever.
And then there is a very confronting scene where he goes to this doctor's office to have electroshock treatment there's actually a warning about in the program. And I said, oh, no, that's fine. I don't mind watching that. And then once I realised it was that scene, closed my eyes, snuggled up into the freezing cold corner of the theatre that the Hayes Theatre had manufactured for me to sit in and just went to my happy place. But you watched.
Oh, my God. It was so rough. It was really rough. I kept thinking, oh my God, he's had to do this twice today. It was a two show day.
So you mean like it looked physically draining on the actor?
Yeah, and for me to watch it. It was just because it wasn't just physical pain, it was he was trying to eject everything about his identity out of himself in that moment. And, oh, God, it was grim.
I also felt that Matthew Bakker was a kind of a slow burn as a performer. In the beginning, I thought, yep, that guy's good. And then I was like, oh, and he sings really nicely too. And then he was starting to play all these other characters, women and, you know, and other sort of people in the community. I was like, oh, well, he's versatile. And then he started to really do these beautiful monologues where he talked about his relationship with his family and the struggles he was going through. And then there was obviously just this really dramatic stuff that he delivered. Mm. And by the end of it, I thought, like, what a beautiful performance. Like, what just incredible commitment to the material and... just, it was just very beautiful and very sad.
And to give another nod to Hayden T, that moment where he kind of scoops Alan up and saves him and brings him back to the fold and to look to nurture him.
It was interesting. The timeline of the play changed in Act 2, and it actually suddenly, for at least a while there, it evolves in real time. So it's actually happening, whereas it's been jumping from week to week and day to day, and then there's a 10-year jump and all this sort of thing, all of a sudden... it's happening as it's happening. He's in the office, he's sick, he's at home, he looks like he's going to die. I assumed he was going to die.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden they're running around like something's happened to Alan, and it's all, it was very like final scene of Rent, Mimi in the park, she's got the fever, you know, Colin scoops her up, brings her upstairs to the apartment. Like, you just basically want these friends to come together and fix everything, and they do, and you're like, thank God, Alan's going to be okay.
But, however, you do bring up the point earlier that Tim was absent, the main protagonist was absent for most of the second act.
Yep, and his character changed a lot as well. He grew into this sort of black turtleneck-wearing writer man.
That was the only thing that kind of took me out of it a little bit. That's what made me go, oh, okay, this is meta. This is...
Because they do at least 10 minutes of his play that he's writing, and it's like about Russian spies and...
Actually, that was fun when they acted out the play. Yeah, yeah.
It gave Ben Hall an awesome chance to show his comic chops, where he's like playing a spoof version of the character that his character has written in a sort of plummy, poncy British spy voice that he was doing. That was really funny.
But, yeah, I feel – because I feel like I've seen that 100 times of, oh, they want to be an artist, they want to be a singer, they want to be a creative type.
Here's the show within a show.
Show within a show, yeah. So – that felt a little bit done for me, but I still enjoyed his journey and him wanting to not just settle in Sydney. And
well, he was basically confronting the age-old dilemma of, I'm a successful creative person in Melbourne, or a potentially successful creative person in Australia, and this is a dead wasteland of the arts. So do I stay here and try to stick it out because this is where my people are, or do I leave my people and take that huge personal risk and go overseas to become creatively successful? Okay, I'm going to do that. And everyone else is going, but we're sad because you go.
Yeah. And why can't we make it and bring it here? I'm sick of people going.
I know, right? How many of them have gone?
From the neighbour's standpoint, they do their three-year contract and off they go to Hollywood. No, just stay here. We can crowdfund some productions for you guys.
We'll, I think, as long as they eventually come back. Look, once the rivals dry up, once the girls are over 40 and the roles dry up, they'll come back crawling back here.
Oh, God, it's so sad. And we haven't given her a lot of airtime, but Blazey Best as Ginny, unbelievable.
And a bunch of other smaller characters, it should be said.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, incredible. Well, Blazey Best is a Sydney theatre person, so we don't see her so much here, but I certainly know her from her performances, Yitzhak in Hedwig and the Angry Inch, the IOTA production, which was... pretty amazing, pretty formative for those of us who saw it as teenagers.
And she has, she's working against one of your pet peeves, Jelly, and that she's got a very memorable stage name.
Just brilliant. What a legend. And she's also just, now when she was on stage, you felt safe.
Yes.
You felt like this woman would not blow a line if you put a gun to her head and ordered her to do it. Like, she just knows her stuff.
Nothing. She makes none of it look like work. It's just part of her. She just makes the whole thing look effortless. Right from the moment that Tim walks into her flat and she's like, oh, you don't want to stay here. And I'm like, yeah, stay there.
Stay with this woman. It's this comfortable like, there. Yes, this hard-bitten and yet somehow maternal woman will take care of you, Tim.
She'll look after you. And even right from the moment where he gets the letter from Cliff to go to dinner and she's like, okay, well, she's straight away like, okay, well, just make sure you know what you're doing here. And what was it about not being seen in public, but like... Oh, when the note said, well, we'll be discreet. She's like, yep, good, make sure it's discreet. And
discretion assured. Yeah. I think I got the impression, I don't know this, but that was like the code at the time for, okay, we all know what we're doing here, but we'll make sure nobody else does. It's very Mad Men, actually.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, there's a bit of that.
But, yeah, I felt very safe with her. And
yeah, it's funny when you say she makes it look easy. I'm always reluctant to say that because it belies the extraordinary amount of work that, you know, someone has put into making something look easy. But I also think at the same time, it's the highest compliment you can pay, like an actor or an athlete or a dancer or something. I don't see the work here. I just see you living these roles, like, yeah. Incredible.
And that's not to say that the others you
no
were showing the,
very,
their work.
No, but... she's a very experienced performer. Like, she's just done it all. What an incredible CV. I really love the choreography in this show.
Yep.
It was subtle but so effective. Every now and then they'd dance all together, doing like a bit
loved
of jazz
it.
Hands.
Loved it.
Yeah, and really played the comedy. And there was a bit of work from Blazey dancing and Hayden dancing at different times. And just, yeah, it was really, really well done. So good work.
And for a show that wasn't a... extravaganza, a cast of thousands.
No.
Like, it was a 5-person ensemble piece.
But when they're all on stage,
yeah,
like nailing it was great.
Yes. So I think, yeah, there was a lot to be said for the intimacy of it, the fact that it was just piano and their voices and these big emotions really gave it a lot of
absolutely
strength.
So that's Ellen Simpson as the movement director there is the description, not choreographer.
Oh, movement director of movement.
Yo.
Do we need to talk about the Eternity Equality set piece?
Yeah, that was interesting. I sort of forgot about that. It's interesting that's not what stayed with me at all. If you hadn't mentioned that, I would have forgot it totally.
Because it's ever-present. So the staging, it really is all just kind of grey. I'm not good at talking about staging, so you can help me describe it.
Well, it was pretty minimal set
and
just a little bit of lighting. For the most part, it was all the set stuff was mimed, which did lead to the thing with the dog, the invisible dog.
Oh, we had some confusion.
God, that was weird.
I thought
that did not work.
I thought it was a taxidermy dog.
Well,
this
I think
Guinea's dog.
Early on, we're led to believe that Guinea's dog has died.
Yeah.
She then apparently, I think, mimes this invisible dog for the rest of the show and everyone else just goes along with it to appease her because, like, she's a bit crazy and she loved the dog so much she wants to pretend it's still there. However, in a show where they're pretending that all the set is there because there's no set and they're miming everything.
Except the bed, which I thought was awesome. The bed was there.
Well, thank God we got to see that. oh, God, that's so thirsty. it's really confusing because they're miming everything. So you're like... is the dog really there or not? It was
just
bizarre.
That's why I read it as a taxidermy dog that she kept patting and talking.
But it moved in their imagination.
That was like, I could have done without the dog.
I would just cut the dog from the script. I would email Alex and be like, I love your play so much. Please can we cut the weird dog thing?
I thought you were going to raise the suitcase packing in the lounge room situation.
There's also this dramatic scene as Tim decides he's going to leave and they're about to take him to the boat to go and he's like... He's packing his suitcase in the lounge in front of everyone. And that was maybe a direction thing that we could have done without. It's like, we know he's going.
That took Jelly out of it. However,
why is he only just packing now?
However, we had flown to Sydney and I had packed that morning.
In the lounge room?
In the lounge room. in the next room because my room looked like a bomb hit it. So I was pulling clothes out of the wardrobe and moving them 2 rooms over so I could get a lay of the land. So for
actually,
me,
actually,
like,
I have to admit, I have done that.
Yeah, maybe he just needed a neutral zone to get his stuff together.
And it was to make us and the other characters extra sad that he was even going.
It was the physical symbol
him.
Of the suitcase. And by the end, we were just like, please don't go, don't leave us. But even right at the start of the show, every time Tim or Cliff did anything, we were like, my feelings.
Oh, it was a powerful emotional punch. So talk about one of the things they did have on one little set piece that they used was a projection on the wall of the Eternity sign. I'll just link on the podcast to the history of the Eternity sign if anyone's interested in it.
Because it's a very Sydney thing. And as Melbourneites,
I was vaguely aware of it. It was, you know, chalked on the side on the footpath for a long time. Eternity, you know, lit up the Harbour Bridge around the millennium with the Eternity thing. And the show... took the current issue of marriage equality in Australia and sort of it inserted into the show by talking about, you know, there's a very powerful and beautiful final monologue delivered by the drag queen character, delivered by the drag queen. at the end of the show, and it reminded me a little bit of The Angels in America, The World Only Turns Forward. You know, some of those, and the end of Harper's monologue in Angels in America on the airplane about, you know, there is this sense of hope. And, you know, an audacious thing to write in 1988 when the gay... when AIDS hadn't even really hit its full peak in Sydney. But this idea that you are okay and you'll be all right and you're connected to everybody. I mean, that was the point at which I just started to bawl my eyes out. I was like, oh, my God, my feelings.
Not to mention when the word morphed into the word equality.
Yeah, but in a way that pulled me out.
Oh, okay.
I know, so you really liked that.
Well,
Eternity morphs into equality. Hayden opens his robe and it lights up with the word equality.
Well, for me, by that stage, the show's over. And this is the curtain call. So okay. To me, it didn't really matter at that point. I'm like...
I was just sort of in the world of the show.
Yeah.
And it did pull me out a little. But I appreciate where they're going with it.
And it almost has to get to that point. Because why are they even doing this show? And the actors afterwards said some words about fundraising and passed the hat around. And...
Yeah, well, they talked about fundraising for Chechnya. So that was nice. But again, I'm like, oh, I'm being pulled in 25 different directions here. I don't know which part of being gay I'm sad about right now. I think I'm just sad about all of them.
Yeah.
Oh, wait, no, I'm hopeful about all of them.
Yeah.
Oh, no, I'm sad again. Oh, but equality, oh, but Chechnya. Oh, but
AIDS, please take my money. Where do I put my money?
Just like, yeah, it was just a feels whirlwind. And when I say I sobbed, I didn't sob, but there were tears running down my cheeks. And that's... I might have one manly tear very occasionally in the corner of my eye, but to actually physically cry, it's like far out.
I was pretty excited. I cry like every day. So just like, what is happening?
I would really love a copy of this script because some of those monologues and everything were so beautiful. I want to give it to everyone I know who's auditioning and be like, this is your new audition monologue.
You can email didn't the writer write a lovely message in the program?
I really am going to email him and be like,
with his Hotmail?
Yeah, I tried to buy the script, but you can't get it. You know, I can't find it anywhere. It was really interesting to talk to some of the performers after the show. Hayden said he went to his manager and said, find me a role that is the most different to Javert that you can find because I want to do something different and this is it. And I said, like, well, what a role. And he was like, oh, no. And he said he loves performing that monologue, the toilet block monologue.
Yeah, there's just a lot to be said for people tackling that kind of meaningful work with such passion and then taking it out to the hallway after to the foyer afterwards and trying to do more good with it.
I thought it was nice that to say, look, we recognize despite our battles in Australia we actually are we're in a position of relative privilege.
Yeah,
so we want to acknowledge gay people elsewhere in the world for whom things are way worse. Right,
so that's why we couldn't talk about it immediately. We needed a week reprieve. So, why is it called, just quickly, Only Heaven Knows is a song from the show?
Yeah. The songs felt a little bit like interchangeable in parts. Mm. There were some love songs, there were some sort of heartbreak songs, and to a certain extent it felt a bit like they could have been moved around at different points in the show.
Yeah.
But it was either Tim or Cliff who sings the song that has that line, Only Heaven Knows. Like, it's a dilemma. So I'm in a dilemma and I don't know what the answer is. Only Heaven Knows, essentially, right. I believe. I must get that David Campbell recording and have a listen.
It's on YouTube, actually. There's a David Campbell
clip on YouTube. Oh, good work. Nice stalkery there. So a week later, what do you feel like stayed with you the most?
Just the emotional connection with the performers.
Yeah.
The rawness. Yeah, just that the romance of that relationship. Not, as someone who's now in the eighth year of my long-term relationship, getting to see not just the beginning of a relationship play out, but you see the initial spark, then you see them living together and the conflict of what you do in the future and taking that next step and into the unknown and how to sustain that relationship for that amount of time. And
great.
Yeah.
If you could change one thing about the show... what would it be?
I would have put a couple of mics up the front.
Really? I actually didn't mind once I settled in. I was totally fine with the singing.
Okay, but the actual show itself.
If that's what it is. If what you would change would be in a perfect world, look, it's in a bigger venue, there's an orchestra and they're mic'd, that's fine.
Well, I may have put... No, I liked Piano Guy. He was good though. But maybe one more belter of a number would have got me across the line. Yeah, sure. I could have lost a couple of the lounge songs.
Yes, good. Yeah, good point. If you were to recommend this show to other people, what grounds would it be? your primary recommendation?
Just the importance of the story, the way the ensemble worked together, the fact that we get four gay characters and their female friend is such a rare
nice to not be recipe. Forgotten. In fact, there is a Guinea has a fantastic monologue at one point where he says something like, "You wouldn't understand, you're a woman," and she turns around and is like, "Excuse me, let me tell you about discrimination and about people's like attitudes to me." And Guinea, you know, this is what I deal with. And I thought, wow, that was really smart and well done and well uncertain. And I would love to ask Alex Harding and say, is there an inspiration with the character of Guinea, you know? Because that was, you know, that's somebody who has listened to women, clearly, that has written that. So that was really wonderful.
And what about you? What would you send people to this with in mind?
I guess it would depend on the person. If it's a theatre-going person, I would say this is an era of Australian theatre that we don't know much about.
Yeah.
And I'm very interested in, I'm becoming very interested in material written in the 80s during the AIDS crisis, exploring homosexuality at that time, seeing the different takes that people were having on it, you know. Really the only other stuff I've seen exploring that era is Holding the Man by Timothy Congreve, which was a book but has been turned into a play more recently. Actually, I saw Eve Mori in that show. Eve Mori, Sonia from Neighbours, did an incredible performance in that show when it was on. And that show's, you know, it's a movie now and whatnot, but that's it wasn't actually written at the time. So this is the only Australian work I've seen of that era.
Yeah.
And I thought it was – so I would say go because this is an incredible piece of Australian theatre history. If you're a theatre goer, that's why you want to go. If you're Joe Average, just go because it's great. Yeah. You know, it's a great show and it's very beautiful.
And use it as an opportunity to put yourself in an alternative perspective.
Exactly. Yeah. No, if you're Joe Average, I would be like, you need to go and get schooled because you need, you have some learning to do about other people and their problems.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Vaya, for coming on in.
Thanks for coming to Sydney with me.
Oh, my God, it was the best. We're going again. I would go again to Only Heaven Knows, except I'm too tired. I can't handle that amount of crying again. If I was in Melbourne, I'd be there again next week.
There is a cast change, so.
Oh, yeah. We want to acknowledge Matthew Backer, beautiful performer that he is. We'll by now be replaced by Tom Shara, who's the assistant director, because Matthew's going off to do an STC play, if you don't mind. And yes, so thanks to Like Yes Productions and The Hayes for bringing this little slice of history and joy to us all. And I'll be charging you for eye makeup ruined and tissues consumed.
Thanks.
Bye.